This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The debate continues about the future of Social Security. New proposals seem to hit the papers every day, and it's far from clear what, if anything, will change. But outside of that policy debate, Social Security is just one factor in the increasingly complicated formula that Americans use to pay for their retirement. When it comes to retirement finances, what sources do you rely on? How much is enough? And how long are you likely to need it? How does retirement change spending and lifestyle? With so many doubts about government programs like Social Security and Medicare, what's the prudent course? To get some perspective on those questions, we'll ask a couple of experts about the economics of retirement and about how to make a realistic plan. Later in the program, we'll talk with a reporter who drove the Baghdad airport road just hours before American troops shot and killed an Italian intelligence agent on that same dangerous highway, and your letters. But first, the economics of retirement. If you're retired, about to retire, if you're trying to figure out what you need to do now to retire down the road, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Richard Birkhauser is an economics professor at Cornell University, also co-author of a textbook, The Economics of an Aging Society, and he joins us now from his office in Ithaca, New York. Thanks very much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Neil.
Could you give us a picture of today's retirees? What does their economic profile look like?
Well, the good news is that the population that's now 65 and older has more income and is in better health than any population before that. So the news in general is good. But behind the average, which has improved regularly over time, there's great variance in the outcomes of people.
More income and better health. If you've got better health, you're going to need more income.
Right. That's in a sense, it's the essence of the problem of Social Security too. The wonderful news about our society is we're living longer. The problem is, do we have the institutional structures to allow us to make sure that we have enough money to last us until we go.
Now, one of the things you write about, you think it's important, a distinction between income and wealth. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, income is the amount of money you get each year from your wages, from interest, from dividends. But what particularly you want to worry about in older age is when it's less likely that you'll be able to increase your work if you need more income is your wealth. And the key decision that people have to make is when do they think it prudent to retire, to leave that long-term job, and do they have enough wealth, stock of wealth, of income-generating assets to allow them to have a comfortable retirement.
And obviously, this calculation varies for every individual. I mean, for example, if you own your house outright, you need less income.
That's right. A couple of things. First of all, there are assets that, in fact, are annuities, and Social Security really is an annuity. It's a stock of wealth that lends you or gives you so much income each year. And so we have almost all retirees have Social Security income that comes from their wealth in Social Security. About half of retirees have an employer pension, either a old-fashioned defined benefit plan where your employer gives you some percentage of your highest 5 or 10 years, or now more commonly a defined contribution plan where you and your employer have paid in over your lifetime, and now you have a stock of assets that you have a lot more control over. The good news is you have a lot more control over it. The bad news is it's a little bit more uncertain about how well those stocks and bonds will do over the rest of your lifetime.
And that latter category, of course, is 401ks and the like.
Exactly right. And that's now becoming, for younger workers, that is clearly the dominant source of private pension assets. But for people currently retired, they're much more likely to have had a defined benefit plan. But for people in their 50s now, it's about mixed, half and half.
Well, what's the main source of income for most retirees?
Well, certainly for the lower half of the wage distribution, they have to mainly depend on Social Security benefits. Social Security benefits make up more than 50% of the income of everyone in the bottom 50% of the income distribution. Then in the next 20% after that, Social Security benefits are the most important income source, but it's not in itself over 50%. And then in the top 30%, they're much more relying on stocks and bonds or employer pensions.
Mm-hmm. Now, the conventional wisdom is, I guess it's an old rule of thumb, after you retire, you can rely that your spending will be down, what, 30%?
That's right, and that's because you don't have the expenses related to being employed. You don't have to have those commuter tickets anymore. You don't have to buy those suits, and you don't have to do the lunches that you do. So your costs, your general costs related to business decline, and also you're unlikely to have to support more than a spouse, and often your spouse has been employed also. So the key thing is you're talking about a much smaller household size.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of retiring Americans, here's an interesting way to put it, what percentage of retiring Americans are okay financially?
Well, I'd say one-third of Americans are in very good shape. They have sufficient wealth and other sources of income that no matter what happens within any reasonable array of ideas, they're going to be fine. And then I think another third of Americans are in pretty good shape, and unless something really dramatic happens to them, they're also going to be in pretty good financial shape, not only now but in the future. Then we have the other third of Americans who really are on the borderline of concern. The bottom 10%, in fact, are in poverty. They were in poverty over their entire lifetime, and when they retire, they're not going to be in much better shape. Then the next 20%, the rest of that third, are people who are not in poverty. While they were working, they were okay. If they don't have some major hit to them, they'll probably be all right, but they certainly should be concerned.
How do factors like ethnicity, race, and sex factor into that?
Well, the very good news is if you're married, you're in pretty good shape. Very few married couples are in poverty, and particularly married couples who have who both partners have worked over their lifetime, and they own their own home, and they've had a couple of kids who they can depend on, they're in great shape. If you're single and you're a male, you're in fairly good shape. But if you're single and a female, you're much more likely to be in poverty. And unfortunately, what happens is over the entire retirement period, of course, most people are married, and when they're retired, they're married. But women are generally marry men that are three to 4 years on average older than them, and then men have lower life expectancies than women. So I think the most perilous time for a woman is after her husband dies. Is there going to be enough to support her as a widow? And I think that's where there's much greater concern than particularly just for people who are married and just entering retirement. And then with regard to race, no question that African Americans are much more likely to be in that risky third or middle third than in the top third.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you mentioned earlier that we're in better health than we were before. But along with living a little bit longer, aren't people working a little bit longer too?
Well, they are. And that, in my sense, is a good thing, because most of the people who are working a little bit longer are working not because they have to, but for the most part because they want to. So what we're seeing is we had dramatic declines in the labor force participation rate of men after World War II through 1950. It was very common to see men working into their 70s. After the 1960s, there was a rapid decline in the normal age that people retired, from 70 down to 65 in the 1960s, and down to around 63 by 1985. That's held pretty constant at 63 since then. what we're seeing is, especially in the last 10 years, an increase in employment after retirement. That is, after someone leaves a career job, we're seeing many more people moving into secondary jobs. For the most part, they're doing it not because they must, although there are some people, but because they're healthy enough and they have enough skills that they can, in fact, work part-time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you get you don't get full Social Security benefits until, well, now it's up past 65. I think Alan Greenspan said half of those eligible start taking their benefits at 62.
That's right. And what's happened is that we had a tremendous increase in the real value of Social Security benefits in the 1970s and early 1980s. Part of that was planned, and part of it was an accident by double indexing. So for a while, we were actually paying people much more than we anticipated that we were going to do, and we had to correct that, and that's the notch baby problem that still bedevils some congressmen with people complaining about that. But what happened with that is that we gave a tremendous increase in real Social Security benefits, and a lot of workers realized that their Social Security benefits were a lot higher than they thought, and they were willing to retire at 62 and take 80% of those benefits. So that increase in wealth allowed workers to retire earlier than 65 and still have a fairly comfortable existence. The problem is that some of them were a little short-sighted, and so for the men who retired at 62, they were doing a great job, but then when they died and their widows were there, getting that 80% benefit rather than 100%, they were less well off than if the workers had worked a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And we just have a few seconds left. I was going to ask you a question about historical perspective. I'm not sure 15 seconds is enough time to answer it. But broadly speaking, was the relative ease of retirement, say, in the 70s and 80s, is that the anomaly?
Well, I think that in part it was, and that we had not yet taken into consideration the dramatic increase in life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now we have to recognize that with the Social Security problems that we have to rethink whether 62 is a reasonable age for people who are increasingly living longer.
Richard Birkhauser, thanks very much for being with us today.
You do it.
Richard Birkhauser at Cornell University. More after a break. This is Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about life after the gold watch, how Americans are preparing for and living during their retirement. Of course, you're invited to join us if you've recently retired. How are you balancing your lifestyle and your finances? If you're planning for it, what's your strategy? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now is Walter Updegrave. He's at his office in New York City, a senior editor and columnist at Money Magazine, the author of We're Not in Kansas Anymore, Strategies for Retiring Rich in a Totally Changed World. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here, Neil.
So we got in the last segment a picture of the economics of those who are retired or about to retire now. For the generation that's looking towards retirement, what are the most important changes that you're thinking about?
Well, a lot of these are things that people may be coming aware of. I mean, one of the big changes, of course, is that Social Security isn't as the system isn't as secure as maybe we thought it was before, and the whole idea of what the actual benefits will be is sort of a little bit up for grabs right now. The other thing is that one of the main places that people got retirement income from, a company pension plan, the pension plan where you got a certain amount each month that your employer paid out, those are basically disappearing. And so there's a lot more emphasis on saving on our own, either money that we just put away ourselves or through something like a 401k type savings plan. So there's a lot more, the onus is a lot more on the individual to sort of create their own income in retirement. And some people are kind of aware of this and maybe haven't really adjusted to it. And some people seem to be going on blithely as if, their things haven't changed and they haven't really prepared.
Or it'll never happen. That's the other area of denial. What about the options of those who, however, have already retired and may know now that they haven't saved enough? Are there things that they can do?
Well, once you're already retired, I mean, your options begin to narrow. You're always have more options when you have more time to plan. But no matter how whether you're sort of on the verge of retirement or even in retirement, there are some things you can do. For example, Richard Burkhalter mentioned this, some people are going back to work, either working longer or going back to work. And for some people, if you find yourself in retirement and you just don't really have enough to kind of live the kind of lifestyle that you want, one option is to try to go back to work and earn some more money. So that's one thing people can do. Another thing is a lot of people, one of the benefits of the real estate boom of the last few years, a lot of people are sitting on quite a bit of money in their home in the form of home equity. And there are ways to get some of that money out. And I don't mean just taking out a home equity line of credit. There are reverse mortgages that can be structured so you get a continuing income stream from that equity, but you also are able to live in the house while you're doing this. There are also some programs that have just come out where people can sell their life insurance policies for cash. These are used to be geared toward people who were sort of terminally ill, but now they're sort of slowly making their way inroads into people who are just older and are looking for ways to convert some kind of asset into cash. So there are some things you can do, but of course, the best thing for anybody who isn't retired is to begin planning early.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Marie. Marie's calling from Lake Havasu City in Arizona.
Very good talking to you. I can't believe I got through. Anyway, my comments are, earlier they had talked about being retired. I'm 73 and retired, and as a widow, that our living expenses have gone down. We don't have to pay for cars and buses and all that kind of stuff. However, I am spending more money now, as an example, in the grocery store for myself as a widow, almost as much as when I was spending for my family. And as far as the individual retirements and saving this money, fortunately, my husband, we were able to, several years ago, put some money away in some IRAs, and only because we had inherited a little bit of money. And however, 4 years ago, I lost $50,000. I mean, that brought down my retirement benefit, you know, what I had put, we had planned on aside, mm-hmm, from Social Security. That made a huge, almost a 50% reduction in our savings. So when they're talking about, you know, putting them into individual things, we did that. But people that are living on the line and right on the line, they can't, where are they going to get the money? They're barely making ends meet when they're feeding families, if I'm in the position where I am. Mm-hmm. So it's just that, you know, our sons and our my grandchildren, these are the things that I'm concerned about. And I think the people that could do it did put money aside. But in this day and age, it's very, very difficult. And as a retiree, telephone bills have gone up. Gas has gone up. So we're, you know, it keeps going on with nothing coming in. Mm-hmm. And if I have to take something out to keep up, something goes wrong with my house, as an example, I had to replace a door, I had to replace a new doorknob. Those things all cost money that do not, I can't replenish it. I can't put it back.
And didn't necessarily calculate it in the first place. Walter Updegrave, Marie, among other things, is talking about inflation.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, Marie brings up, I think, two very important points here. One is living expenses. A lot of people, when they're going into retirement, they tend to think of, oh, I have, you know, whatever, a couple $100,000 stashed away. Maybe I need to draw out $30,000 or $40,000 a year. What a lot of people don't factor in is that $30,000 or $40,000 a year, that amount they withdraw from their savings is going to have to rise to compensate for rising prices, for inflation. So a lot of people kind of underestimate the effect of this inflation, and that gives them a false idea of how much they can pull out when they first retire and how long that money is likely to last. So one of the things that I ask people to do in my book, for example, is when you're on the verge of retirement, even a couple of years before, sit down and try to do some sort of a budget of how much you're actually likely to spend, and then if you don't feel comfortable doing this yourself, sit down with some sort of a financial planner and actually figure out how much, you know, on an inflation adjusted basis you're going to need, and then do you have enough assets or enough resources to be able to sort of meet that income need. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, a lot of people, Marie mentioned losing about $50,000 in her IRAs. Some people remained invested much too aggressively, particularly toward the end of the 90s, because the returns were so good. As people approach retirement, you really have to sort of begin to shift some of your money out of equities and into bonds. And another thing that a lot of people should consider when once they are retired, if they don't have a pension and if Social Security isn't covering their sort of basic living needs, they might want to consider taking some of their money, not all of it, but some of it, and buying what is called an income annuity. Basically, this is something that provides you with a steady stream of income, and you can just now you're beginning to see some companies offering these annuities with an inflation adjustment so that you buy, let's say that you get $500 a month to begin with, and then it rises with inflation. So these are the kinds of things that kind of can protect the purchasing power of your money during a retirement that can easily last 30 or more years.
Marie, I heard you trying to get in there. I'm sorry.
Yeah, actually, we had invested in a single premium equity policy. And that's where I really, really took the hit. And about 3-4 months down the line, I went to my broker and I said to him, you know, something's going on here. I got to do something. Well, at that point, we switched over to bonds. So I'm now in bonds, but I'm not, you know, needless to say, the return, but it's a lot safer situation. But nonetheless, that was still, it's $50,000 less than what it would have been. And we've just got, we were very, very cautious in the type of, it was basically equity and type of bonds and mutual funds.
Well, Marie, I think your advice, caution and prudence, is something that we're going to be hearing a lot for the remainder
exactly,
of the
Exactly, exactly. And I Thanks. Think I live very prudently, and I'm doing well considering what I'm, but basically when I'm talking for other people that are not in this position that I'm in. I mean, I'm not.
Well, Marie, let's try to talk to a couple of them, okay?
Okay.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you so very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk now with Barry, and Barry's calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in a what one might describe as a unique situation. I was an airline pilot.
Uh-huh.
And I'm forced by federal law to retire at age 60. And, of course, we don't collect Social Security until 62 at the earliest, or 66 in my case.
Mm-hmm.
The second step to that is that you haven't gotten into this yet, but I'll get into it for you, and it's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
And that is a lot of airlines have gone declared bankruptcy and declared they're not going to be paying their pension plans, and so this is kicked over to the federal government, and the federal government is paying you a lot less than you'd probably counted on.
Well, they haven't started there yet. What happened was the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is proposing to take over only one of the four pensions at United Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
The second step to that is that the airline has decided that it's going to continue to pay Chicago $500 million a year in it for improvements to an airport that doesn't need to
Barry,
be improved.
Barry, I'm afraid we just can't get into this level of detail in the program. But
Okay. But the point is that the operational expenses of the corporation, they choose to pay for those at the same time they want to eliminate the pension side of the issue.
Well, let's just talk about the retirement impact here. And,
yeah,
and Walter Updegrave, Barry's not alone in the situation of having a pension that he was counting on, and he's not so sure he can count on it.
You're right. Unfortunately, there are a lot of cases where companies have promised benefits and they've either run into problems or they're looking for ways to scale back or they just run into trouble. And so and you mentioned that in some cases people may retire early and they get a certain level of pension income from a company. And then if that company, the pension fails, this Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation does take over the payments, but they'll only pay a minimum level. So people can wind up losing money. I mean, I think that the lesson here basically comes back to if you are counting on a company pension, you have to have some sense of, you know, how secure is that corporation, how secure is that money that you're going to be getting. And you also have to think that you're looking at something where we may be talking about 30 years where you're going to be sort of intertwined with this company's financial financial prospects. So to me, what that means is you've got to do a lot of saving outside of any company pension. So if they have a 401k, save in that. If they don't have a 401k, try to make sure you take advantage of things like IRAs or Roth IRAs, or just do regular old savings in mutual funds, or if you're up to buying individual stocks, do that. But you've got to put away money aside from just what you may get in a company pension.
Email question from Fred Ryan in Norfolk, Virginia. In the last recession, many families refinanced, cashed out some equity, and therefore reduced the size of their home ownership part of their annuity. How much of a factor is that going to be in retirement?
Well, I mean, to the extent that people have already dipped into the appreciation in their homes by taking out in home equity lines of credit or home equity loans, that sort of thing, there is going to be less for them in retirement. So the money is there, can only be used one time unless you have several years to replenish that equity. So if you're thinking about using this or you haven't done much other savings, then you have to kind of resist the temptation to dip into that equity for other things. This also comes up in a slightly different way in the question of 401ks. You see a lot of people who kind of think of their 401ks as this piggy bank that they can periodically dip into. Mm-hmm. They'll switch companies, and instead of rolling the money over into their new company's IRA or moving it into a rollover IRA where it will continue to grow without being hit by taxes, what some people will do is take it and they'll spend it, or they'll spend a portion of it. That's not a very good move if you're going to be counting on that money for retirement. I mean, the money really is being put aside for retirement, not to fund, the occasional splurge.
Walter Updegrave's book is We're Not in Kansas Anymore, Strategies for Retiring Rich in a Totally Changed World. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on. Lisa. Lisa's calling from Suffolk, Virginia.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air, Lisa.
Yes, I'm getting concerned, I guess. I'm not close to the retirement age, but I'm getting concerned because they keep talking about raising the retirement age. And although people are healthy, I'm not necessarily sure that they're able to work as long as the bureaucrats are expecting them to work. I work with the elderly, and I see them, I see them in their illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure they're able to generate the income,
in their 70s. If that extra income is going to be a crucial factor. Walter?
Right.
Walter?
Yes, I mean that's for somebody who's doing physical labor or who has health problems, then a rising retirement age can be a problem for them. I mean, as things stand now, the Social Security system still allows you to retire at 62, even though they're rising what they call the full retirement age, the age at which you get full benefits. Of course, that means if you retire at 62, you take a bigger cut from your benefits. So I think that, this is a case where people who are in a situation where they don't think they're going to be able to work to that full retirement age, in as much as they can, should be trying to put away other money, during their careers and investing other money. Now, obviously, that's something that some people will have a very difficult time doing. There are people who just, don't have enough to make ends meet.
Indeed, the title of your book, We're Not in Kansas Anymore, suggests that people are mightily surprised when they get to that Technicolor world.
Well, they are, and it's things have changed so much that they're expecting maybe a retirement kind of like their parents, or expecting the retirement to come the retirement income to come from the same sources, and it is a completely different world, and that's why I use that metaphor. I mean, really, the onus is on us to prepare for it, and it requires a lot more decision making on our part. I mean, with the old company pension, you didn't have to worry about how the money was invested. All you had to do was show up for work and retire, and you get the check. With a 401k, you have to make some decisions about how that money is invested. Now, I don't think that these decisions are beyond the capabilities of most people, but it does require a little bit of attention, and most of all, it requires that you sign up for the 401ks, which unfortunately about 20 to 25% of people aren't even doing.
And most 401k plans allow you to, your employer will match your contributions. You're saying they're not putting in contributions to be matched.
No, I'm saying that 20 to 25% of people aren't signing up. Period. Yes, so they're not getting anything. Now there are another bunch of people who are maybe putting something in, but aren't even taking full advantage of the match. That is, they're not putting in enough to get the full benefit of the employer match. So that's sort of like turning away free money. So one of the things in the book, I have a sort of a whole chapter on sort of maximizing your 401k. At the very least, you should sign up and contribute enough to get as much of the match as your employer is willing to give. Usually that's something like if you put in 6%, they're willing to match that 50 cents on the dollar for that first 6%. You should at least do that. But most people should contribute even beyond that if they can.
Lisa, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll take another question or two on retirement. We'll also talk to a journalist in Iraq about that country's scariest 7 miles, the Baghdad Airport Road. That and your letters after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now we're wrapping up our discussion on the economics of aging with Walter Updegrave, a senior editor of Money Magazine. And let's get another caller on the line. And Alan. Alan's calling from San Francisco.
Hi. I'm so glad we're talking about this. It's so timely with what's going on with Social Security now. My question is this. I'm a professional. I work for Kaiser, which is a pretty solid organization, healthcare provider. And our pension is such that ultimately you get 1.25% of whatever you earn times however many years you earn after so many years. So if I work there for a total of 35 years, which I think will probably happen, I'll get 42% of whatever my salary is at the time. There's no 401k matching. So my partner and I, who he's a teacher, we're trying to figure out how do we kind of make this work. So what we did is we bought a house. But homes are way too expensive in San Francisco, so we bought out of the area. So the increase in value is not as high. And basically, I'm wondering, what do we do? Now we don't have money because it's all going towards a mortgage to put in our savings account. Does it mean that you don't do anything else? Do we not, like, spend money on anything else for the next 35 years so that we can live and have a roof over our head? Or, you know, what are some other ways of looking at this? Because it's quite concerning.
Garbanzos for dinner for the next 35 years for Alan?
Well, I have to say that I probably, it sounds like what Alan's done is basically put his sort of retirement prospects on the in line with the real estate market. He's essentially said, you know, since I can't afford to say I can't afford to save very much, I'm going to do all my savings in real estate. And I don't know that that's something that I would do. I mean, you're essentially putting all of your money into one asset class. Granted, it's done very well, and particularly in the San Francisco area, home prices have been going up and up. But I think that you should look at, you know, housing is something that you need, a place to live, and that you should essentially figure out how much of your income do you want to do you choose to use on just living.
Mm-hmm. Also, and that assumption that he will work for however solid a company for the next 35 years, that's less and less common with Americans.
Well, it's less and less common because people don't want to do it, and you have to remember the company may not want you for that long, and or even if the present management does, it's not uncommon these days, and I'm not saying in his case, but it's not uncommon companies get taken over, and all of a sudden you were a star for one set of managers, and now they want to do something completely different. We really, in terms of jobs today, it's very rare to think of staying in one place for that length of time. So basically, if I were Alan, what I would try to do is look at my housing as kind of a living expense and just say, how much do I need to devote to this living expense? And I would try to do my investing elsewhere. And if I don't have a 401k where I work, I would certainly, he and his partner should both look into 401ks. They may, if they don't qualify for a regular 401k because of their job, they may qualify for a Roth IRA. If they have any kind of freelance income, they may be able to do something, a SEP, a simplified employee pension. Or if you just have regular, you know, sort of non-tax advantage managed investments, there are a lot of there's a type of mutual fund out there called tax managed funds, where you don't get an immediate tax break for putting the money in, but the gains sort of accumulate with very little in the way of taxable distribution. So they're very tax efficient. So there are a lot of ways for you to build up savings, and I don't think that, generally speaking, it's a good idea to put all your eggs in one basket, even if it's one like real estate that has done pretty well, at least up to this point.
Mm-hmm. Alan, there's also the lottery, I suppose.
We're playing that, definitely. We're there with you.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Let's see, we get one last caller in on this question. Brad. Brad is also calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
I've been listening most of today, and I'm a broker. I do financial planning. And what I've found with most of my clients and most of the people I talk to is they don't save enough. There's some misconception that what they're saving is adequate, and we show them, or I try to show them, what that money is going to be worth in the future, and that they have to start saving now when they're young. And I think that's the biggest issue, is the young people out there have to make it hurt a little bit, and they have to put away as much as they can while they're young, because that money is not going to be worth that much in the future.
Walter Updegrave, Brad's suggesting that the answer to the question of how much should I save and is until it hurts.
Well, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think we necessarily have to live a life of penury or live like ascetics or anything, but most people don't save enough because they don't have a kind of a real sense of how much they actually have to accumulate. People have a false sense, for example, if they go into retirement with $500,000, people very often have a false sense of how much they can draw from that pot of money and how long it's going to last them. So I agree. It's a good idea. There are some sites on the web. As a matter of fact, if you go to the Money's website, there's a little retirement planner there, and you can plug in some numbers, how much you're currently saving, and it'll give you a little idea of, you know, how much you can actually wind up with 20, 30, 40 years down the road. And I think a lot of people are going to find out that if they want to continue anything close to their current standard of living, they're going to have to save a little bit more, because really that's what it kind of comes down to. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic investment out there that's going to turn meager savings into some retirement bonanza.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking about $500,000. If you look at what that's if you were to retire today on $500,000, you would probably have an income of less than $20,000 a year after taxes and everything. Mm. So people don't realize that, and that's not really a living wage here in California.
And certainly not in San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah, especially here.
Yeah. Brad, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Walter Updegrave, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Walter Updegrave's book, We're Not in Kansas Anymore, Strategies for Retiring Rich in a Totally Changed World. He's also a columnist at Money Magazine and joined us from his office in New York City.